This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, I'm Rachel Wright, and on the Global News podcast, we're following the Emergency Defence Summit in Brussels to address Europe's security crisis. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. Even supporters of the European Union, of that immense late 20th century project to weld the countries of Europe together in common endeavour, even supporters would say that the now 27 member state club can move at a slow, lumbering pace. But these days, the EU is facing the truth that that will no longer cut it. Donald Trump's arrival in the White House has ripped up the old foundations, which is why today there's another emergency summit, this time of EU leaders in Brussels to try to agree a huge boost to defence spending across Europe and then make that happen as fast as possible. And even faster than that, how best to support Ukraine in the face of a US halt to military aid and the pressure from Washington for Kiev to make peace with Moscow. The French President Emmanuel Macron is a leading voice in all this, and he had some strong things to say on the eve of the summit in a televised address to the nation.
Mais compte tenu de l'évolution des menaces, de cette accélération que je viens de décrire.
As soon as next week, we will gather in Paris the army chiefs who will take responsibility for this matter. And so, this is a plan for a solid, lasting, verifiable peace, which we have prepared with the Ukrainians and several European partners, and which I defended in the United States 2 weeks ago and across Europe. And I would like to believe that the United States will stay by our side. But we have to be ready if this isn't the case.
But speaking today, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned that Moscow would see any European deployment in Ukraine as involvement in a war against his country.
We will categorically not observe this kind of action. This will mean not a supposedly hybrid, but a direct, official, undisguised involvement of NATO countries in the war against the Russian Federation. This cannot be allowed, especially after President Macron's nervous statement yesterday that Russia is a threat to Europe, which means that if it is a threat, then troops should be directed against this threat.
The words of Sergei Lavrov. As European leaders arrived for the summit in Brussels earlier today, their words and tone underlined the significance of the moment.
This is a watershed moment for Europe. And Ukraine, as part of our European family, it's also a watershed moment for Ukraine.
I think I'll be a little bit more blunt than usual today. And our message on this day of a special European Council on Defence is that it is about damn time. This is something that we have been asking for a long time, that the European Union, that Europe is capable of standing up on its own 2 feet.
For me, the most important thing now is to be very frank, to rearm Europe. And I don't think we have a lot of time.
The BBC's Nick Beek is our correspondent in Brussels at the summit. Is the EU moving any closer to a concrete increase in defence spending?
Yeah, I think this is difficult, Tim, because it is an emergency summit. So I think expectations are being managed here, and I'm not sure that at the end of today what is agreed or announced will necessarily match the extremely strong language, the stark language that European leaders have been using today. And so today they're talking about not just how they plug the gap left by American military funding for Ukraine, but also how do they completely transform the way that the defence industries in Europe operate. They're talking about pumping billions and billions of euros into those industries.
Are they talking about trying to reorder the way in which the European Union does handle its enormous finances?
Yes, they are. And I think in simple terms, they are saying that they're very strict in some cases. Spending rules will be lifted because this is deemed to be an emergency. So, for example, countries which normally would be in big trouble with the Commission here in Brussels for exceeding spending won't be in that position if it is on defence. So you've got Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the Commission, talking about a 150 billion euro loan fund to help various countries boost their defence spending. If we look at one concrete example, Tim, Germany, fascinating at the moment. They've just had the election there. Friedrich Merz, not yet the Chancellor, but already he's talking about changing the German constitution so that the so-called debt break, basically the limit on German public spending, can be lifted so that they can invest millions more in defence, which they hope, of course, will protect the continent, but also create jobs as well.
Given the more Moscow-friendly stance of countries such as Hungary and Slovakia, how quickly can the EU move on all this?
Well, I think this is an emerging story, and you're absolutely right, Tim, because today it's the meeting of the 27 leaders, so all of the countries in the EU. And the way they do things at these meetings, it has to be a unanimous decision. And notably, Viktor Orban of Hungary, we know he's close to President Putin, more sympathetic to Moscow than most of the other leaders. And he suggested that the facts on the ground have changed to such an extent that these leaders shouldn't be sending out a joint communique about staying with Ukraine for as long as it takes. They should actually be picking up the phone to President Putin in the way that Donald Trump has done and talking about peace. So, I mean, yeah, he could really put a spanner in the works today. But we've seen there are workarounds. And I think also the role of the UK is important here. Sir Keir Starmer, clearly not here because the UK no longer in the EU. But there is a role, I think, for different key figures within Europe to play their part.
Is there any further talk as well at an EU level about trying to liberate some of the money from frozen Russian assets to pay for all this?
This has gone a little bit quiet, actually. What has been talked about, President Macron, he is talking about the possibility of France sharing their nuclear defence capabilities. So, in other words, extending this sort of nuclear umbrella to other countries, notably Germany, if the American nuclear defence is not going to be there in the future. Some leaders this morning arriving seem pretty pleased about that. Olaf Scholz of Germany was saying, in effect, you know, hang about, the Americans haven't gone completely here. Let's not completely disregard the idea of a US nuclear deterrence, which is going to look after Europe in the way it has for, you know, the past 80 years.
Europe correspondent Nick Beek speaking to me from Brussels. Letitia Saint-Paul is a French Member of Parliament with the centrist Renaissance Party. She serves for that party on the member of the Foreign Affairs, on the Foreign Affairs Committee, I should say. Letitia is also a French army officer. She's currently on leave for the military to serve in Parliament. Letitia Saint-Paul, thank you very much for your time here on NewsHour. Do you think the French public really supports a huge increase in defence expenditure, given all your other fiscal problems at the moment?
Our French population has already supported this decision, you know, since 2017, when with Emmanuel Macron, we have chosen to reshape our French armed forces and to give 2% of our GDP to defense. So it's not brand new for French citizens. And this is the politic we have led since 2017.
Sorry to interrupt. I mean, yes, you are just getting to the point of 2% of GDP now on defence expenditure. A lot of people are saying it's going to need to go considerably further than that. And from what I've seen, the opinion polls do suggest that there is not a great deal of support for greater defence expenditure.
Today we face an emergency. It's a question of security, of sovereignty, and this is our role within the parliament to find solutions. And in fact, we said that we didn't want to increase tax and trying to find other ways to borrow money from our citizens. It could be an investment, not an expenditure without no interest, but an investment in our defense and to share it at a European level.
Right. I mean, what about the idea, I mentioned it in our the interview I had with my colleague, the Europe correspondent, Nick Beek, this idea of trying to get the more than $200 billion of frozen Russian assets to pay for, I mean, either for weapons directly for Ukraine or perhaps for the European defence effort. France has been a little sceptical about that in the past. Do you think that that should be explored?
France has always been in favour of a European defence, of a common effort. And as you said a few minutes ago, we are facing an emergency, and what we took into consideration 2 weeks ago has changed. The world has changed. As it's
yeah, and using and impressive. using frozen Russian assets. Do you think that that should be the capital from that should be used to pay for this?
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question.
Yeah,
sorry.
I was just wondering. I mean, there's a huge amount of Russian money that is tied up in Europe at the moment. It's been frozen. Do you think that that should be used to pay for this?
So I don't know if it's in regard of law it's allowed, but if it is, we absolutely need to be creative these days. Just what we wanted to ignore, we can't ignore it anymore. So if the law and our European laws estimate that it's okay, so I mean, why wouldn't we use it?
Do you think that there is a danger in this? That clearly, you know, you have voiced the desire in Europe to show that it can pull its weight, that it can show its power, it can strengthen itself, it can strengthen Ukraine, it can keep Ukraine fighting. That, at the same time, by going down that route, you may widen the rift, the gap with America. Do you see that as a danger? And if so, do you think it's a danger, a risk that is worth taking?
I hope that we won't be anymore a political dwarf, and we are not so ridiculous. You know, all the European budget together, it's about half of the American budget. It's more than the Russian one. So just we've got to be convinced that we are strong as Europeans. We have to reinforce our defense and security, but we don't start from nowhere. So I don't understand why we are collectively so pessimistic about what we are able to do. And as you said, I used to be a French officer, boots on the ground, and I know what we are able to do, especially France and you, the UK.
Letitia Sample, we're very grateful to you for your time. Thank you for joining us, Letitia Sample, a French Member of Parliament. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up on the programme, if you're like me and you get frustrated when you can't get a phone signal on the moon, well, we've got good news. It's arriving today.
It is indeed a major leap. It's a major leap in technology for space exploration because it really allows us to support all future exploration in space. If you think about all the missions that are going to the lunar surface now and eventually to Mars, all of these activities require advanced communication capabilities.
More on that story coming up in just over 10 minutes. Headlines this hour. The head of the European Commission has said that the continent is at a watershed as EU leaders meet to discuss increased defence spending after Washington stopped aid to Ukraine. And the Ukrainian ambassador to Britain has accused the United States of destroying the world order. We'll be hearing more about his speech in 15 minutes. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. We started the programme in Brussels with EU leaders trying to regain their balance in this fast-moving landscape, trying to work out not just how they can continue to support Ukraine and protect themselves, but whether their old alliance with the United States is about to be broken entirely. In contrast, in Moscow, it feels as if Russia is on a much firmer footing now. From Moscow, our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has this report.
The global order is shaking. Alliances are changing. And so is the language. Living in Russia, there are two phrases I've got used to hearing officials and pro-Kremlin commentators coming out with when they lambast Russia's rivals. The first one is the collective West, a derogatory term normally aimed at America and Europe. The second put-down is the Anglo-Saxons. That's when Moscow rails collectively against the US and the UK. At least, this is how it was for several years. But in recent weeks, I've been hearing and reading these phrases less and less. Perhaps that's not so surprising, though. After all, with Donald Trump in the White House, labels like collective West no longer seem to apply. Не та Америка. Instead, Russian state TV's flagship news show kicked off recently with a big strap across the screen declaring America's doing things differently. As it turns out, very differently. A few days ago, we saw the United States voting with Russia, North Korea and Belarus against a UN resolution that identified Russia as the aggressor in Russia's war in Ukraine. Now the Trump administration has paused military aid to Kyiv. By contrast, US-Russia relations are on the up. There have been discussions between Moscow and Washington on repairing diplomatic ties and talk of future economic cooperation. This week, one Russian newspaper described America as Russia's partner. It's just one word, but it represents a sea change. Not so long ago, Joe Biden was calling Russia the aggressor and its president, Vladimir Putin, a murderous dictator. Last weekend, I heard something in the news here that brought home to me just how much things have turned around. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, went on TV and declared that America's new foreign policy configurations are largely aligned with Russia's. America and Russia, seeing the world through similar eyes? So where does that leave Europe? Potentially quite exposed, and certainly receiving most of the abuse. Let me bring you up to date with Russia's new set of labels. European countries that support Ukraine are described here as the old world. European leaders who back President Zelensky are referred to as the party of war, or the liberal globalists. Russian is a rich, colourful language, and I'm sure many more labels will be hatched soon. But there's one other thing that I've noticed. When Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016, some headlines in Russia referred to him as our Donald. Not this time. There's a little bit more caution here, just in case things don't work out. And what looks like being the start of a beautiful friendship turns sour.
And that was our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, reporting from Moscow. Antibiotic resistance is a growing threat, so it's quite striking to hear how the BBC's health correspondent has described the discovery of a new part of the immune system by researchers in Israel. It is, he says, a goldmine of potential antibiotics. The findings have been written up in the journal Nature. Professor Irbat Merbel led the research out of the Weizmann Institute in Israel.
We have what is called a proteasome, which is like a garbage can in each and every cell in our body. And this garbage can is responsible for degrading proteins that are obsolete, finish their function, or that are damaged. And what we found is a new immune mechanism that, in fact, generates antimicrobial agents by the products of these degradations of proteins. So it's like small pieces. Think of a recycling bin, if you will, What we found is that within the proteins in our body, when they are sent to this recycling bin, they actually generate little pieces of what people are now calling like natural antibiotics.
I mean, it's a wonderful image, the idea that you sort of delved inside these garbage cans, as you put it, and you've plucked out something from that garbage can, what can then be used to attack particular bacterial cells.
Absolutely. So what we've done is that we took these little pieces, which are called peptides, even if you produce them outside and just test their effect on bacterial cells, what we found is that they're perturbing the membranes of the bacteria, and by that causing them to die. And these are little pieces are in fact being generated all the time in our body. And this is something that we did not know before.
Well, I guess the possibilities are huge in that case. I mean, one thing, the fact that it's from within the body, presumably that will mean that fewer people, if this can be turned into antibiotics, fewer people would have resistance to or side effects from those antibiotics.
Absolutely. And you touched upon one of the key advantages. You do not react to them. And again, I don't want to generalize because it's only the beginning and this, you know, finding is now being highlighted in Nature and so on, but there is plenty to do until we get into the clinic. But there should be potentially more safe because they do not alarm our immune system as something that is foreign. And so if this is indeed the first line of defense, what we showed in the paper very nicely is that if you provide one such piece from the outside, even in mice model of, let's say, bacteremia and pneumonia, or bacteremia that causes sepsis, that little piece provided as a treatment can actually protect the mice not only from death, but also really has amazing effect on the tissue damage and reduces all of the inflammatory responses.
I mean, you mentioned a couple of fairly sort of big ticket bacterial infections that you were able to test this new method on. But have you got any insight as to whether it might also be used against the things that are called superbugs, these microbial strains that are seen as, I mean, lethal, but also utterly resistant to the sort of antibiotics that we've got right now?
So, of course, it's too early to know whether that will have the same effect in humans, although the peptide that we chose is exactly the same in mice and humans.
Right. It's a way to go until potentially we get to humans. Can you just tell me what the next stage of this research could be?
Oh, absolutely. This research opens up so many doors because we didn't just identify one such peptide. We identified hundreds of thousands of such peptide, and we still don't know whether we tested them in combination, but we still don't know which bug will be responding to which type of peptide. So we can try now to do a lot of combination analysis. We can then test and ask how it may impact different diseases such as autoimmunity and fibrosis. And it's relevant even beyond infectious diseases in many cases in which we have what we call immune compromised patients, meaning patients that undergo transplantation or cancer patients that may have perhaps a suppressed immune system. This is something that potentially, once we show a proof of concept in humans, may provide a shield, a line of defense that will be missing.
And that was Professor Ibat Merbel from the Weizmann Institute in Israel. More on this story on our website, bbc.com/news. That piece I was talking about by our health correspondent, James Gallagher, in which he writes about this discovery of a new part of the immune system and uses that word, goldmine. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC.
Hi, I'm Rachel Wright, and on the Global News podcast, we're following the Emergency Defence Summit in Brussels to address Europe's security crisis. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to This Old Friend. Ah, the Nokia ringtone of the 90s. And now it's a signal of a phone signal on the moon. It's arriving today, courtesy of Nokia Labs. Thierry Klein is president at Nokia Labs, and he's watching developments from Houston, Texas. And he's been explaining to Justin Webb how this first ever cellular network on the moon is being set up.
You can think of the cellular network as something that's very similar to what we use every day on Earth. It's based on the same cellular technologies that your smartphone and my smartphone use, but we've reconceptualized what that network looks like, optimized it for the environment of the moon. So you have essentially a network tower that's on the lunar lander, and that's where all the network equipment is. And then we have two user devices or device modules that go into vehicles, a rover and a hopper that explore the surface of the moon. And we then provide wireless links between the rover and the hopper and the lander. And we transmit images, video, scientific data, sensor data from these vehicles on the lunar surface back to the lander. Mm. And from there, the information will be relayed back to mission control for all of us to see and enjoy.
So what is the range that you've managed to add now?
So with this current mission, what we're targeting for the rover is about 2 kilometers. The hopper will hop on the lunar surface and will, its main characteristic will be that it will hop into a crater that is not accessible by a rover, but it will hop into a crater and a permanently shaded area of the crater, so permanently shaded from the sun. And this is where we expect to find water and ice, which is, of course, very important for future space exploration.
And what you're saying is that this is a major leap, to use a phrase that's been used before about, or roughly speaking, about lunar exploration. But this really does enable things that have not been possible in the past.
It is indeed a major leap. It's a major leap in technology for space exploration, because it really allows us to support all future exploration in space. If you think about all the missions that are going to the lunar surface now and eventually to Mars, astronauts going back to the moon, scientific experiments being deployed, robotic systems being deployed, human habitats. We do expect to have resource mining, drilling, transportation systems. As we build up a lunar economy and industrial activities on the lunar surface, all of these activities require advanced communication capabilities.
Thierry Klein, president of Nokia Labs, talking about a cell service on the moon. He was talking to Justin Webb. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. We're returning to Ukraine now with the news that 4 people were killed, more than 30 injured, in the central city of Kryvyi Rih, the hometown of President Zelensky, when a Russian missile slammed into a hotel there. To be clear, in recent weeks and months, this may not have been the news we'd have got round to reporting, because there have been so many attacks of this type from the Russian military. But it has a particular resonance now, because a lot of observers have been saying that Washington curtailing its sharing of intelligence with Kyiv will make it all the more difficult for Ukraine to defend itself against attacks such as these. Mark Edwards is a volunteer with the charity Ukraine Relief. He told the BBC what happened.
We got here last night. We checked in at 8 p.m., put our bags in the room, went straight down for dinner. We were having dinner with some local people that help our charity, and we got a text message saying there was an incoming missile, and this was one that was specific to Kyiv. We got up from the table to go to the shelter, and we hadn't barely stood up, and the missile hit the top of the building. It was a direct hit. Iskander missile, which, as I'm sure you guys know, is also one that is a fragmentation ballistic missile. So the streets are covered in shrapnel. There's pop marks in front of us. There was no military people in the hotel. There's not a military facility around it. This was a direct strike on a civilian infrastructure that was designed to hurt international people and aid workers.
Mark Edwards, a volunteer with charity Ukraine Relief, speaking to us from Kryvyi Rih. There's been an outspoken intervention as well from the Ukrainian ambassador to the United Kingdom today. General Valery Zaluzhny accused the US of smashing the world order as we know it. We're joined by our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Frank, tell me more about what General Zaluzhny has had to say.
Yeah, well, I've been at the Chatham House conference that he's been. He was the first part of the first session this morning. And he is, of course, Ukraine's ambassador. But for 3 years, he was the chief of the head of Ukraine's armed forces. And so he's used to speaking his mind. And he has said, look, for some time, Russia and other countries have been trying to reverse the US-dominated world order, the international rules-based order, as it's been known since 1945. But he's saying the final nail in that coffin, or words to that effect, is being done by the United States, that it is, in his words, destroying the international rules-based order. And he warns that NATO could cease to exist in its present form, and that Europe is going to be the next target for Russian aggression. So, I mean, it's extraordinary, really. I mean, I would have to say that there are two narratives coming out of Ukraine. There is the very conciliatory one coming out of President Zelensky, who realizes that standing tough in against the onslaught, the verbal onslaught he received in the Oval Office last Friday from President Trump and his Vice President J.D. Vance, has not helped Ukraine one bit, because we've seen the very impetuous response from the Trump administration, which is to cancel military aid, cancel intelligence sharing, issue various warnings. So the president's office is being very conciliatory, and he sent this letter, which Trump likes, which is sort of a form of apology and saying it's regrettable and he's willing to sit down and sign the minerals deal and talk about peace talks. And then you've got this very outspoken intervention, as you put it, coming from Ukraine's ambassador here, who's telling it how it is and how Ukrainians feel.
Yeah. And he's also, I mean, intriguingly, I mean, he's the man whom President Zelensky sacked as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces last year and farmed him out to be the ambassador in the United Kingdom. I mean, do you think that, I mean, clearly, General Zelensky is probably giving voice to what many in Ukraine may be feeling, but do you think that there's a possibility that it could be something also to do with internal politics there?
I'm not sure he's that much of a political machinator. He stands very high in the polls. If there was a presidential election in Ukraine tomorrow, the polls show that his popularity stands at 70%. Zelensky stands at 57%. And the people who Washington are allegedly talking to, opposition leaders who are in opposition to Zelensky, are only polling about 20%, so people like Yulia Tymoshenko. And I think there will be a lot of resentment in Ukraine at the suggestion that the US, it might possibly be trying to engineer some kind of regime change in Ukraine, when Zelensky, whether Mr. Trump believes it or not, was democratically elected. And this idea that he's a dictator because he's hanging on to power is, of course, a load of nonsense, because Ukraine is under martial law, and under Ukraine's constitution, elections cannot be held under martial law. And there's a good reason for that, because you've got millions of Ukrainians internally displaced, millions who are now in the diaspora, in not just in Europe, but in the United States, and you've got millions who are living under the Russian boot in occupied oblasts of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Luhansk, and Donetsk.
Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, thank you very much for joining us. Well, during that Oval Office confrontation 6 days ago between Volodymyr Zelensky on one side, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance on the other side, one of the sticks that the two men used to beat the Ukrainian president was over recruitment. "You're running low on soldiers," said President Trump. "You're going round and forcing conscripts to the front lines because of manpower problems," said Vice President Vance. There is no doubt it is getting tougher for Ukraine. 24-year-old Serhiy Hnezdilov volunteered for the Ukrainian army when he was 19. He expected to serve for 3 years, but Russia's full-scale invasion meant his service became open-ended. Like many Ukrainian soldiers, he complained that this was leading to exhaustion and burnout. Unlike others, he did so publicly, in a blog, and then by deserting. He went AWOL to make a point. Serhiy was detained last October and held in a military prison, but he was released under an amnesty for first-time offenders. He's now back on the eastern front lines, fighting near Donetsk. From there, he's been speaking to my NewsHour colleague James Kamarasamy. They discuss the recruitment problem, his actions, but first, given this week's developments, whether he thought Ukraine could cope without US military aid.
The question is, do we have a choice? We need to do everything possible to cope.
and I'm just a bit surprised that sometimes our foreign friends, allies, don't really understand that we actually weren't given a choice by Russia other than to carry on. Because if we don't continue fighting, then we're going to have another Bucha or Mariupol or other horrifying stories like that. It's going to be tough, but I'm certain that we will find the resources to carry on, to defend our people, and we will definitely find a solution to this situation.
Well, let's turn to your story, Serhiy. You are back on the front line, but you were not there for some time. Tell us how you came to leave the army, because you joined it in 2019, didn't you? You fought for many years, but you did decide to leave the army without permission in September. What led to that decision?
Я, по-перше, дуже вдячний BBC за увагу до моєї історії і за те, що ви...
I'm very grateful to the BBC for following my story. I've been fighting as a soldier for 5 years. I'm also the founder of a festival and the People's Initiative. That's another project I'm involved in. I've also hosted a show on one of the biggest media platforms in Ukraine. And I've spoken publicly and loudly about the need to be very precise about how long a soldier should serve and how their service should be timed and have a very distinct beginning and end. And also, I've been advocating for what I call the doctrine of war, that everyone has to fight. And we've been talking about these things, me, the other NGOs, lots of representatives of civil society, but we've never been heard. And given that, I made a decision to draw more attention to this issue by publicly going AWOL, because the problem has reached a catastrophic scale.
And that decision to go AWOL led to you being detained for several months. What was that experience like?
Це цікавий досвід, насправді, тому що, ну...
It was an interesting experience. It helped me understand, firstly, what it felt like being behind bars. It was a strange yet valuable experience. I got to read a lot, I talked a lot to my friends who visited me, and I came to lots of conclusions while there.
What sort of conclusions?
Напевно, я б більше і детальніше, і глибше говорив би про це на внутрішньому.
The most important message is that freedom is vital, and you have to fight for it. And my NGO, the People's Initiative, will continue fighting for specific defined terms of military service. We are soon going to launch a legal helpline for Ukrainian service personnel.
Has your time being detained, has it made a difference? Do you think what you did made a difference?
Абсолютно вірно, тому що про це очевидно почали говорити.
Absolutely, I believe that it did make a difference. People started talking about this issue. They stopped ignoring the problem. And now we have a promise from a parliamentary committee that they will make some legislative changes in May. That's what they've promised us. And it's very sad that the war has been going on for 3 years, and we could have made this change at the very beginning. And for 3 years, it's been damaging the state.
Now, the act that you carried out, the way you decided to show what needed to be done, namely to desert, to go AWOL, it wasn't welcomed by quite a lot of your comrades. Can you understand why people, some people, thought it was wrong to do what you did?
Звісно ж, ні, я абсолютно не можу зрозуміти такої точки зору, я не раз.
I certainly do not and cannot understand this, and I've said it many times. Some of us are at the front line and have been fighting for a long time, while many others are ignoring their responsibilities under the Constitution. It's their right to agree or disagree, but most of the hatred that was aimed at me was not constructive or factual.
Now, you're back on the front line, and this is because you were released, because this was your first offence. What has it been like since you've returned? What kind of reaction have you had from your fellow soldiers?
Ну, це люди, з якими я служив тривалий час. Дехто був в такій...
The people that I came back to, these are the people I was fighting with before, and some of them actually were in the same situation as I was. But there were no really fervent reactions. Everybody understands that people fighting at the front get tired. Now I'm back fighting once again with the unit that I left, and overall, there's been no big issues at all. What's more, we've been promoting bringing those who've deserted back into the army, and furthermore, at the same time, when I publicly went AWOL, according to official statistics, there were 80,000 cases of military personnel going AWOL.
Fascinating voice to hear. Serhiy Gnezdilov, and he was speaking from the front line in Ukraine to James Kumarasamy. This is NewsHour from the BBC. Both the US and the UK have recently announced significant cuts to their foreign aid budgets. The effects on the ground are already being felt. The UN's World Food Programme has announced that it's cutting food rations for Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh by half. Asif Saleh is with the Bangladeshi relief organisation BRAC. He's been telling our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain that the foreign aid cuts are going to be felt throughout his country.
We don't have any strong social protection mechanisms. So as a result, we depend on active civil society organizations and governments to focus on building up these things and lifting people out of poverty. NGO sector now employs almost 500,000 people, at least. So huge amount, thousands and thousands of jobs are going to get eliminated. Bangladesh was the USAID's largest program in Asia. So in terms of its impact, particularly on healthcare sector, has been massive in this country, particularly around vaccination, reducing child mortality and maternal mortality. This USAID has played a massive role in this country.
Why should the United States foot the bill for all of these aid programs, not just in Bangladesh, but around the world?
From a justice perspective, it's important to understand that this is a price that the most marginalized people of coastal Bangladesh are paying because of the profligate nature of development that happened in the West. So that's one aspect. But the other aspect is if you're the richest person in your neighborhood and you think that you can just be like that and all your neighbors are going to be poor and you can live in peace, that's also not going to happen. They're going to come knocking at your door. They're going to come try to cause challenges. They're going to be regional instability. Bangladesh is hosting 1 million refugees from Myanmar. So in a way, Bangladesh is playing a major role from a regional security and peace perspective. Now, if you stop the food, if you stop the subsistence and stuff, what happens? I mean, it's going to be back to the drawing board. I mean, there's going to be, again, huge regional instability that would be caused. So as the sort of the leading superpower, as the leading sort of country in the world, I think it's important to think that what happens outside their border also affects them, and it's important from a moral perspective to provide this support.
Asif Saleh from the Bangladeshi relief group BRAC. Bangladesh itself has gone through a remarkable change since last year. It's 7 months since a student-led uprising drove the long-ruling Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina from office and brought the Nobel Prize-winning economist Muhammad Yunus to power. Here he is speaking to Samira Hussain when he arrived back in Bangladesh in August last year.
How do you feel?
I feel good. I'm back. There's a lot of work to be done. People are excited. People know that something, new opportunities have arrived. So we want to catch that.
What is your message for people here?
Discipline. Discipline. Hard work and get it done.
That was Muhammad Yunus arriving at the airport last year. Samira has spoken to him again and has asked him first what's changed since August.
I was dazzled when it came. I had no idea that I'll be leading the government and how to make it happen. So that's the zero point. We come in and still waiting to see what needs to be done immediately. First one, of course, the law and order situation, which is a big task. We are coming from a complete disorder and uprising, people getting shot. So that's my first phase. And for me, a learning process also. I never ran a government machine. And see how the institutions, the bureaucracy, the government can function. Because everybody you talk to say, oh, he's agent of this. He is the one who did that. So come at those levels of distrust and kind of trying to see how do you work with people that you don't know anything about.
I want to pick up on law and order, because what people have been saying to us is that they don't feel like it's been getting better, that it's actually been getting worse, that they're fearful of going out at night. Why is that still happening? Why isn't it getting better?
Well, better is a relative term to what we're comparing with. If you're comparing with the last year, for example, at the same time, it looks okay. We are not an ideal country, an ideal city that suddenly we make. It's a continuum of the country that we inherited, country that was running for many, many years. So it takes time to install that fear and install that discipline to make things happen. We take the collapsed country into order, into some discipline, some kind of policy, some kind of hope. This is what you're trying to do.
When talking about members of the Awami League, right now there is a sense that there is a political witch hunt happening, that the judiciary has been politicized, that they don't feel like they have the freedom to be able to speak.
Are you comparing with the previous one or just the ideal one?
You're the head of Bangladesh. People within your own country are saying, look, I'm part of the Awami League, but I don't feel like I am safe.
So you're talking about the law and order situation?
I'm asking about whether, A, is there law and order? Is enough being done to protect?
If there's a court, there's a law, there's a police station, they can go and complain, register their complaint. This is the way you just go, don't go to a BBC correspondent to complain. You go to the police station to complain and see through whether the law is taking its course.
When do you plan on having elections?
I made it very clear that if reforms can be done as quickly as we wish, December will there be a time that we'll hold elections. That's
will the Awami League be able to participate in those elections?
They have to decide whether they want to do it. I cannot decide for them.
Will you allow them to participate?
Who am I to allow them?
You're the head of this country.
Election commission will do that. Election commission decides who participates in election, who doesn't. It's not the prime minister who decides.
The interim leader of Bangladesh, Muhammad Yunus, speaking to the BBC South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for listening.